You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, June 22nd, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate Online Magazine. She'll be talking to us about the Supreme Court, recent rulings, and how Clarence Thomas seems to be the most ethically challenged Supreme Court justice in the history of America. As far as I can tell, maybe not. Pretty close, though. We don't know enough about him. Folks, want to take this time to thank some members randomly chosen from our member machine. I want to thank Sunshine Jim joining the program from British Columbia. Christopher H., a member from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We missed him at the meetup. I'm not saying last names because I'm not sure that people want their last name. I don't know. Bruce A., from Dallas, Texas, thank you all for joining this program. And I want to thank a one-off donor, Susan B. Thank you for your generous one-off donation. And folks, one more bit of house cleaning. I am hoping to send out a poll soon, just to get a take a temperature read on what people are liking and disliking on this show. So if you are listening to the program and you are not sure, I haven't sent out an email blast in quite a while, but if you're not sure that you're on the email list, you can go to majority.fm, sign up for the email list. In the right-hand corner, there's a blue box that says sign up for the email list. And you sign up with your email so that you can take this poll. I'll be sending that out shortly. Let's get right into this. It turns out, now I know this is going to be a huge surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
Folks, please sit down when I tell you this. It seems that Sarah Palin?
Be either.
I guess so. Sarah Palin had set out a magical mystery bus tour of the United States to get a feel for what real Americans are all about. First, she went up to the Northeast following a pack of motorcyclists, I guess. I'm not exactly sure. From what I understand, they were basically trying to issue an injunction order because she was, like, stalking them. And they're like, why are you following us? She went up to the Northeast, and her plan was to swing back through the Midwest, and, well...
Surprise, surprise!
Sarah Palin, she quit her own bus tour halfway through. Because, you know, it gets... Listen, I can understand it. I got news for you. If I had made the millions of dollars that she had made after quitting her job as governor to make all those millions of dollars, and I was stuck in a bus, and I realized, like, meh... Press doesn't seem to care anymore. You know what I'd do? I'd say, okay, let's just quit. I mean, who's going to really care? I quit the governorship. You think people are going to criticize me for quitting a bus tour, for God's sakes? No. People are going to remember that I quit the governorship. So if somebody says, like, hey, Sarah, how come you don't even have the wherewithal to maintain your own bus tour? She can say, hey, I quit the governorship to make money. Don't talk to me about a stupid bus tour. I didn't get elected to do a bus tour. I got elected to be governor, and I quit that. So you don't think I can quit a bus tour? Seriously? Man, are you stupid. So Sarah Palin has bailed on her own bus tour. We're going to take a break. We're going to get to Dahlia Lithwick. When we come back after Dahlia Lithwick later in this program, more from the senile old bag of bones who actually picked Sarah Palin to be the Republican vice president nominee. Also, a rather depressing, but maybe it ends well, story of a guy who robs a bank because he wants health care. Yes, and I should tell you that it's not like the bank is giving out health care. It's not like one of those deals where you put in a deposit, you get a toaster, you rob the bank, you get health care. It's not quite that seamless. We'll have more on that later. And also, the machinations behind what I believe will be the oncoming tax holiday for U.S. international multinational companies that have been hiding their profits overseas. But more on that later. We'll be right back with Dahlia Lithwick. Ladies and gentlemen, we are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar, and on the phone, it is a real pleasure to welcome the senior editor of Slate Online Magazine, Dahlia Lithwick. Welcome back to the program, Dahlia.
Hi, Sam. Thank you.
So, Dahlia, let's talk about this this pretty big court case that came down. Just a day or two ago now, at the beginning of the week, it was a massive, 10-year class action suit against Walmart, representing more than 1.5 million women. Tell us about this case.
Sure. This would have been, if not the largest, certainly one of the largest class action suits in history. And as you say, this is more than 1.5 million female employees trying to get into court to file a monster suit alleging that Walmart discriminating, violating Title VII by consistently favoring men over women in pay and promotion matters.
Tell us what Title VII is. Just for
the anti-discrimination law that, you know, simply just a civil rights statute that says you can't discriminate. And they come forward and they say, we just want to form a class. We're not arguing about the merits. This case has never gone to trial. The only question is whether the class was certified properly in order to go forward. And the court essentially said on Monday, you know what? The class was improperly certified. It's not enough. that these women, the only thing they have in common is they're all alleging discrimination. They're going to have to come back, if at all, and file individually or under a narrower class. But in effect, without ruling on the merits at all, the court closed down the entire class action before it ever had a chance to begin.
Now, let's talk about this. This was settled. This was a unanimous decision, yes?
Well, there were two different provisions of the statute that were in question. There was a majority. There was a 9-0 decision that this. One part of the statute that says you can't seek back pay under a provision that really only allows you to get injunctive and other relief. So the entire court more or less said they kind of came up the wrong tunnel. They should have filed under a different provision of the statute if they wanted back pay. So that's the easy question. The controversial question comes down 5-4, and you don't even need me to name who is in the 5 and who is in the 4. The 5 conservative justices say, oh, by the way, you can't come back and file again under the correct provision because you can't file this suit at all. You know, this is not an appropriate class. So 5 justices with Antonin Scalia, the most conservative, or one of the most conservative justices on the court, writing for the 5 conservatives, and by the way, the 5 men, only one other man on the court, Stephen Breyer, votes with the 3 women in the dissent.
So this is an important distinction to make, because it's being widely reported as a unanimous decision, and it is in terms of one particular aspect. But the real damaging long term, because one is a ruling on a very technical question about a way it's filed. The other is about a much broader question that's going to have far more implications, not just for this suit, although this suit obviously is dead as a class action suit. But for suits going forward against large corporations like this. And that's the part that is really important that you're starting to get to, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, if under the 9 justices would have said under they filed under the wrong provision, come back and file again. 5 justices said, we don't care what provision you file under, we will never certify a class like this. This doesn't work. And so it really is, I think, a mistake to talk about this as 9-0 court shutting down a class action suit. This was 5-4, which isn't to say there's no implications. There's certainly implications to the technical question they answered as an entire court. But the implications, I think you're right, of the 5-4 decision are absolutely enormous in terms of filing this type of suit, using the kinds of evidence these women sought to use. They sought to use a lot of data and numbers and information that has always been allowed as proof. Scalia, unimpressed, shuts it down. So really, I think in terms of the ripple effect in the future, the big, big, big issue here is that the court says this kind of pattern and practice proof that they tried to put forward showing that there was discrimination is not allowed.
All right, so let's break this down, because, you know, this has got to be seen also in the broader context of a court that has been very hostile to class action suits. And class action suits obviously allow many litigants to come together, and essentially it allows them to afford legal representation, because if they have small claims against a large company, there's no way they can, as individuals, afford to pay for a lawyer or attract a good lawyer to fight a major corporation unless the payoff is going to be big enough, and that's why people pool together. So in this instance, what was the class trying to prove that would have allowed them standing as a class?
The way to establish that you are a class for the statutory purposes here is to show that you have, quote, common questions of law or fact as amongst every member of the class. So that's the rule. And these women said, we have common questions of law and fact, because even though Walmart doesn't have a written policy that says, hey, let's discriminate against our female employees, they afford so much discretion to every single local manager that when local managers managers say things like, you know, if you wore makeup, you might get a promotion, or we're not going to give this promotion to a woman because men are the breadwinners and women just recreationally work. Those kinds of things that were said by the managers represents a pattern, represents a policy that allows there to be discrimination. In other words, there doesn't have to be centralized policy to discriminate. It has long been the case for class action purposes that you could say, you know what, the effect is so discriminatory, and particularly the effect of giving huge discretion to local managers is so discriminatory, we can still come make a claim. That's what Scalia shut down in this 5-4 opinion. He said, you know, I'm looking at the written policy, and it says we don't discriminate. So why would anyone, as a manager with lots of discretion, ever discriminate? So that was really the nut of it. He said there wasn't enough in common between all these various women in the class to come forward as a class because they had different jobs, there were different managers. These are so many different instances of such different types of discrimination that he says there's nothing in common. And in fact, I think the nut of his argument, Sam, is that there's no common answer to the question, why was I discriminated against? He uses the word, there's no glue holding this class together.
Now, this is sort of, it's a little bit of a catch-22, right? Because nobody is adjudicating on the question as to whether or not all of these women were discriminated against. Because you can't get to that question until you can actually say whether or not they have standing, which means essentially they have the right to come before the court in the manner in which they are as a class. And so you have these anecdotes and this data that cuts across that in one form or another, women, these 1.5 million women who are working for Walmart were discriminated against. Their pay is lower. Their ability to move through the ranks is lower. Their numbers in management is lower. All of these things, which are simply assertions, they have yet to be proved or not proved. But the argument is this makes a pattern. We're all discriminated against. And Scalia basically made it impossible for anybody to make that claim against a company this large, right? I mean, so in other words, the only way that these women would be able to get redress is if they could organize in, according to Scalia, in groups that were discriminated in exactly the same manner. I was passed up for a promotion, let's say, and these people break down into groups of, we were passed up for a promotion. Other groups, I was told to sex it up on the floor or whatever it is. Is that basically what Scalia is calling for?
That's what he's calling for. I think there's also some real question in reading his opinion about what kind of evidence he would accept. He says that the anecdotal evidence is sort of very, very weak is the word he uses. All these are literally over 100 affidavits of women who tell the kinds of stories you and I are telling about how they were treated. He says that's weak evidence. He also says the statistical evidence, which, again, this isn't new. Civil rights lawyers making these kinds of claims have for years been allowed to rely on statistics to show that an employer has a pattern and practice of discrimination. Scalia just really laughs off the statistical evidence and, in fact, uses the word sociologist who had put forward this evidence the way many of us use the word, you know, serial killer or person who has dead bodies in the attic. I mean, he scoffs and is so contemptuous of a sociologist bringing forth data. And so I think it's not simply that these women don't get redress. And this goes to your original point, Sam. A lot of these women cannot afford to file individual suits. Some of them make $8 an hour. They don't have the ability to come back and file their own suit. And certainly, I think another really important reason we have class action in litigation is because they also can't always prove what they want to prove. One of the reasons class action litigation is so useful is because you can prove things in the aggregate that you cannot prove as an individual. So now those doors are shut to them. And I think one of the real questions, and we don't really know the implications of this lawsuit, although I think we're going to find out, but one question is not only what happens to the evidence, what kind of evidence is legitimate, how do you show pattern and practice of discrimination, but another question really is, have we profoundly limited the way people can come forward in class action suits, particularly, and this is so important, because Scalia relies on the fact that they have a written policy of non-discrimination.
I mean, obviously we can't look into the future, and the way that the law works is going to be how this ruling is used in the future by other attorneys and how other courts respond to it. But if you, and when we say in terms of proof here, we're not even talking about a burden of proof in terms of the actual case. We're just talking about whether or not they all have had the same relationship essentially with Walmart, right? I mean, we're not even talking about a burden of proof to actually prove and win the case. We're just talking about that they actually can come forward. So if you do not allow, if there is an absence of a policy that says we discriminate, and you do not allow any statistics that show women have been discriminated against in the context of working for Walmart, and you don't allow anecdotes, I don't understand how people could ever bring, even have the standing to get into the doors of the court to ever bring this case.
Well, that's right, and you said earlier, and I think it's important, this isn't the first case in which the court limits the ability for someone to come into a court and simply ask the question, will someone hear my claim? Not very much earlier in the term, the court decided a major, major case involving AT&T that also limited the ability to file a class action suit. So this is part
of
a big...
And in that instance, they actually overruled a state law that allowed for that class action stuff. So they went even further than just barring the door. They said nobody can, not even a separate state can open up this door.
That's exactly right. And I think if you look at it in the large scheme of you know, the trends of the Roberts Court not finding standing, limiting class action, using ripeness and mootness and all sorts of reasons to kick litigants to the curb, it really looks like it's part and parcel of this big, big systemic effort to say corporations win and individual little lonely litigants who really have no other mechanism to hold the big, big corporate America to hold their feet to the fire. They have no access to a courtroom to prove that. And one other point that is so important, Sam, that we should make is that Walmart had actually changed its conduct in response to this lawsuit. They were doing a lot better, and it shows what a huge, huge amount of leverage the threat of a class action gives employees. And when you take that leverage away, there is no incentive. If you take away the ability to have a class action lawsuit, there is no incentive for big employers to think about what their employees are saying.
Now, Dahlia, tell me what was the evidence that they changed their behavior?
Well, I think they've started posting. I mean, some of it seems like fairly trivial, but I think they did start posting signs of their positions open. They did change their pay rates. They did do
some. But isn't that evidence? Isn't that sort of like evidence, prima facie evidence that there was a problem?
Certainly. I mean, shows that they're conceding earlier.
I mean, if they're saying that, like, we're going to do better, that suggests that they were doing badly enough, at least so that these people could make their case. I mean, let me ask you this. When we see this trend by this court to really, this isn't even determining cases on their, on the law or the fact in favor of corporations, it is actually fundamentally barring the ability of non-corporate players for actually even attempting to use the courts, the civil courts, for any type of redress. Is this court in any way ideological, or are they just corporatist?
Well, it's a good question, and it is a good question about how this dovetails with, other Roberts Court principles like federalism, states' rights, the very notion that courts are meant to be humble and that judges aren't meant to be activists. All of that flies in the face of a ruling like this. And so I think it's a good question. How does this map onto the rest of the stated ideology here? I do think this is part of a long, there's a famous Lewis Powell memo from 1972 before he came onto the court where he said, you know, to the Chamber of Commerce, we need to regain the courts. We need to use the courts as a weapon to, you know, re-empower corporations in America. And I do think, Sam, that's the important thing here, is to realize that this has been part of a long-standing effort by big corporations in America, decades-long effort, to start to shut down the systems in court that leveled the playing field between employers and employees. This is part of just a very, very long, very well-thought-out war against the, you know, the court intervention in these kinds of employment matters and these kinds of corporate wrongdoing. So I do think it's quite right that it doesn't necessarily dovetail with the other stated ideologies of the court's conservatives. It is certainly part of a trend that has been well documented empirically in the last 4 or 5 years, that corporations always win in the Roberts Court.
I'm sure it's just a coincidence. And, you know, let me, I appreciate the time you've given us. I know you got to run, but let me just touch on briefly all the things that are coming out about Clarence Thomas. Now, there are, my understanding is that the Supreme Court essentially changed the rules in terms of their ethical conduct like 10, 15, 20 years ago. Is that right? I mean, my understanding is I thought they were subject to sort of the same sort of ethical code of conduct as other federal judges. But then at one point they basically said, you know, we're best suited to make that determination.
I think that's right. I think that they claim that they use it as an advisory set of rules. I don't know what that means, but that they're not bound by it. And all of these ethics rules about judicial conduct, and really, really, they're so bound up, it's so important to say, in the appearance of misconduct. In other words, the ethical rules aren't don't be biased, don't take money, you know, don't give speeches to partisan groups. They're don't do anything that would make a litigant think you're hopelessly biased against them. And so these appearance-based rules do not apply to the Supreme Court justices. And so many of the conflicts we're seeing come up now, really not even on the merits do we have to determine whether they in fact cause a conflict. They just create such a pattern, a Rorschach test that is impossible to read as anything other than there's a conflict here. There is bias.
And why is that? Why is that so crucial?
Well, it's crucial because the integrity of the judiciary stands on one thing alone, and that is the belief of the American people that the court is fair. The court doesn't have an army. It doesn't have a treasury. What it has is the confidence of the American people that the court, by and large, is impartial and unbiased. And the reason the ethical rules are focused on appearance and not actual conduct is because appearance is what matters to the American people. We need to believe that the court is being fair. And so it matters. Matters, I think, fundamentally, because the entire existence of the judicial branch for hundreds of years in this country has rested on a sort of bargain, a promise of good faith and good behavior by the justices in exchange for the American willingness to suspend disbelief that judges are political animals, just like other politicians. And when I think you systemically show that you think one side over the other should prevail on these kinds of questions that are going to come before the court, then what you are showing the American people is that bargain is off.
You know, so when we talk about Clarence Thomas, we're talking about his attending a Koch-sponsored political fundraiser. And if he was subject to the code of conduct that other federal judges are, he would not be allowed to do such a thing. When he failed to disclose his wife's income, how much it was and who it was from, it was from right-wing think tanks and outfits, and he then, after even disclosing it, failed to disclose the right amount, I guess. When he talks about when we talk about his wife leading an organization that opposes the Affordable Care Act, almost surely to be headed to the Supreme Court. When we talk about the fact that his wife actually makes money off of the Citizens United case ruling because she works with those organizations that have basically been unshackled by that law. This is the type of stuff that drove like a guy like Abe Fortas out of office, and would, if he was sitting anywhere else on the federal bench, drive him out of that position, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that part of what has become very, very confusing about the conversation, the way it's ramped up in this past year, and here I confess, I read the New York Times article this weekend about the museum in Pinpoint, Georgia, and the big sculpture on Clarence Thomas's death, and I was quite honestly confounded as to how clearly that is an ethical violation. But I think you're quite right that it's not that you can sort of draw a line and say the things on this side of the line are clearly improper, the things on this side or not. It is simply part of a massive, massive sense that Clarence Thomas holds one group in favor and one group in real disfavor. And I think that's what's really, really becoming problematic. Any one of these instances, the trips, you know, the plane flights, the sculpture on his desk, the museum, the Koch brothers, any one of them would raise sort of red flags that why is he have a dog in this fight? I think it's the mass of the evidence that shows that he really, really has certain views that are going to inflect the way he looks at cases. I think that's where it just has become so very problematic.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com. Slate.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
We've got to take a break, folks. When we come back, we will have more. Oh, so much more. Much more. Be right back. Back, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Which one do you want first? The inspirational or the, well, maybe equally inspirational, but not necessarily in a positive way, story? How about this one? This story from NPR. 10 days after the attacks of September 11th, there was a guy named Reyes Bullion. He's working at a gas station in Dallas. Some douchebag comes in named Mark Stroman, mad about 9/11, comes in with a shotgun, says to this guy, the Bullion thought it was a robbery, opens up the cash register. This guy, Mark Stroman, says, "Where are you from?" And Bullion, who was from Bangladesh, Bangladeshi, didn't know really how to react. And next thing he knows, in his words, "I felt the sensation of a million bees stinging my face, and then I heard an explosion." Bullion was shot in the face. He required medical attention for years after the attack. The bullet hit him on the right side of the face, leaving severe injuries, particularly to his right eye. He had to go through many different surgeries. The doctor saved the eye, but there's no vision there. He's still carrying more than 35 pellets on the right side of his face. He went through a bunch of painful surgeries. And then, make it worse, his family, still living in Bangladesh, as soon as his family heard the news, his father suffers a stroke. So, and he used to send money back to them. So meanwhile, this guy Froman, apparently, years later, is now facing the death penalty. And Bullion basically has this to say: "According to my faith in Islam, there is no hate. No killing. It doesn't allow anything like that. Yes, Mark Stroman did a horrible thing, and he brought a lot of pain and disaster, sufferings in my life. But in return, I never hated him. He's created, this Bouyan has created a website called World Without Hate, basically to educate people about hate crimes. And he, along with Amnesty International and Stroman's defense attorney, have filed several appeals on Stroman's death sentence. This is what Bouyan says. I strongly believe executing him is not a solution. We will simply lose a human life without dealing with the root cause, which is hate crime. In Islam, it says that saving one human life is the same as saving the entire mankind. I should also say that's the same thing with Judaism. And I don't know for sure that it's in Christianity, but one would expect. Since I forgave him, all those principles encourage me to go even further and stop his execution and save another human life. Wonderful spirit. Of course, you know, you only hear that on NPR. You're not going to hear that on Fox or probably even the mainstream media. But to me, that's an unbelievable story. Because while I don't believe in the death penalty, or I believe in it, but I don't believe that we should be instituting it anywhere in this country, I imagine that if I got shot in the face, I'd want to kill that person. Or anyone I know or love got shot in the face, I'd want to kill that person. If not personally, I'd want them killed by the state, which is exactly why people shouldn't be making those decisions, why it simply should be outlawed.
I think life in prison is a much bigger punishment.
It probably is, but at the end of the day, that's not why I'm rooted against why I'm against the death penalty. I'm against the death penalty because there should be no justification to take another's life. That is what civilization is. It's you have laws to essentially basically say we mete out justice, not revenge. And when the state says it's okay to take a person's life, they're basically saying it's okay to take a person's life. Then all we're doing is debating on the merits of what circumstance justifies it. There's another argument against the death penalty, which California is finding out. There was a study done by two senior legal figures in California. It's according to the Guardian UK. Arthur Alarcon, a professor at Loyola Law, and Paula Mitchell, I guess also presumably from Loyola Law School, they don't take any position on the death penalty. They just try to figure out how much does it cost. And apparently it costs $300 million per person executed. Over the past three decades, there are 13 prisoners who have been executed in California. It costs over $300 million per person. Since 1978, California and the U.S. government have spent some $4 billion on the state's death row. Only 13 prisoners have been executed at an average of $308 million to kill these people.
I don't get what costs this much money. Like what?
Because you've got appeals, you've got evidence. It is they're very long processes. The study reported by the LA Times warns that the total figure will rise to about $9 billion by 2030. $9 billion over the next 20 years in attempting to kill these people. Now, the death penalty can only be overturned in California by referendum. So it'll be interesting to see if voters actually deal with that. But, you know, for a state that has a budget shortfall of $25 billion, the idea of recouping, you know, what is it, $500 million a year by just saying we're going to put them in prison the rest of their lives. It is the extra security involved in death row adds to about $100,000 a year per prisoner extra. The initial trial costs more than $1 million on top of that life without parole case, and each appeal costs $300,000 in lawyer fees. So, I don't know. That's not the reason to oppose the death penalty, but it is a reason. Meanwhile, for those of us living...
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, or lay, or lay.
Somebody's cracked the code.
The voice of the lonely goat herd, lay, or
somebody lay, has cracked the code, ladies and gentlemen. They figured out how to get free health care from the state. Let's listen to this report from Colorado News 9 about a North Carolina man who decided to rob a bank in Charlotte, and why?
First time I've ever been in trouble with the law. So it's not, you know, it was, I'm sort of a logical person, and that was my logic. That's what I came up with.
That is how James Verone says he came to the decision to rob the RBC Bank on New Hope Road on Thursday of last week. He had no gun, but handed the teller a rather unusual note.
The note said, this is a bank robbery. Please only give me $1.
Then he did the strangest thing of all.
I started to walk away from the teller, and then I walked back and I said, I'll be sitting right over here on the chair waiting for the police.
And that's what he did. Listen to the teller on the 911 call to police.
He's sitting on the sofa. Did you walk in the front door?
So why did he do everything he could to get arrested?
Because I wanted to make it known to whoever would know that, you know, it wasn't done for a monetary value, it was done for, you know, medical reasons.
That's right. James Verone says he has no medical insurance. He says he has a growth of some sort on his chest, two ruptured discs, and a problem with his left foot. He's 59 years old and with no job and a depleted bank account. He thought jail was the best place he could go for medical care and a roof over his head.
You wanted them to arrest you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I went in knowing I was going to jail.
James is hoping for a 3-year sentence. He figures he'd then be able to collect Social Security when he gets out and says he'd head for the beach.
I already got a condominium, spoken to the realtor on Myrtle Beach.
He knows his story is unusual, and he doesn't recommend doing what he did to anybody else. But James Verone says he has no regrets. He says he's getting good medical care now, but the jail doctor accuses him of manipulating the system.
If it's called manipulation, then out of necessity, because I need medical care, then I guess I am manipulating the courts to get medical care.
So we, there you have it, folks. Worried about your health care? Don't worry about cuts to Medicare or Social Security or any of that. It doesn't matter. You can always go in and rob a bank. Get a couple years' worth of care if you have some type of disease. That's what it's come to, folks. That's what it's come to. I got a lot more stories. I'll either get to them in the post-show or tomorrow, depending on those stories. And if you are listening to us live, please join us in the post-show. You can IM me at Majority FM. We talk issues. We talk personal things. I answer personal questions. Very, very personal questions. Infuriatingly personal questions. You can always become a member at Majority.fm. Folks, I need more members. Don't know how to really put that in a more polite way. Need your membership. Appreciate you buying your junk through our Amazon link. Costs you nothing. Sometimes you get a break when you buy through Amazon. Usually it's cheaper than in other places. And they actually kick back a couple of Amazon shekels to us. Redeemable at actual stores. And, of course, if you go to justcoffee.coop, you can purchase some fair trade, great tasting coffee, tea, chocolate, 10% discount, coupon code MAJORITY. You will not regret it. I guarantee it. I will guarantee that. All right, folks. See you tomorrow.